couple weeks ago, we watched the movie Hercules. Woo! So much fun. And in the story of Hercules, there is the music in it is... It's one of the best things about Hercules is just the music. And, of course, one of the best, there's a lot of good songs, but one of my favorite is when these muses kind of go on a gospel thing and they sing all about how Hercules goes from a zero to a hero just like that. And it's a great thing as this no-name, nobody, Hercules becomes strong and mighty, and now everyone knows him, and it's such a great, great thing. But what's interesting is it doesn't continue on. You know, that song really kind of needed to be reprised. And I'm going to steal a line from my son who wrote an essay about this, and it was called From Hero to Zero. Because Hercules, after becoming big and straight, great and strong, all of a sudden ends up in some difficulty. It happens sometimes when you have some female troubles. And in those female troubles, he goes from the super strong, can't be stopped, to all of a sudden having absolutely nothing. No strength, no friends. Even Phil is hopping the first boat out of there. It's bad. He went from the top of the world to nothing. It's interesting that this is what's going to happen with Paul and Barnabas as they enter into these couple of cities. One of the things that I just find absolutely insane is how quickly man's praise can turn into hatred. It's crazy how quickly we go from praising someone or maybe receiving that praise to being absolutely nothing. That's why in my email I sent out, this is a story of from praise to death threats. Now that's rather extreme. And that's what we're going to find here in Acts chapter 14. So let's start there at Iconium. Paul and Barnabas went, as usual, into the Jewish synagogue. That was their MO. They went to the synagogue first to find and preach to the Jewish people. If that didn't work, then they would go and preach to the Gentiles, though there were a lot of Gentiles that were often there in the Jewish synagogue. And there they spoke so effectively that a great number of Jews and Gentiles believed. But the Jews who refused to believe stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brothers. So Paul and Barnabas spent considerable time there speaking boldly for the Lord, who confirmed the message of his grace by enabling them to do miraculous signs and wonders. The people of the city were divided. Some sided with the Jews, others with the apostles. And there was a plot afoot among the Gentiles and Jews together with their leaders to mistreat them and stone them. But they found out about it and fled to the Lycaonian cities of Lystra and Derbe and to the surrounding country, where they continued to preach the good news. Now, the reason why this story is important is it's going to come in later on about these particular people. This whole group of people that does not like Paul, does not like Barnabas, does not like the story of Jesus Christ. And so they feel that it is their mission, that is their duty to do everything they can to stop Paul. And so they're running around poisoning people's minds. They're stirring up the crowd to say, you should not listen to them. You should not follow them. And then they find out that there's a death threat. Now, this becomes problematic. Whenever we find ourselves in a situation when our lives are on the line, we often have the fight or flight response. As a Christian, we've talked about this a little bit, but it's starting to come up even more and more. When do you fight? When do you flee? I think it's hard when it's not us. I could have probably said to Paul, hey, why are you worried about these people? Why are you worried even if there's death threats that are happening? I mean, come on, Paul. Doesn't he protect you? Doesn't God watch over you? Why stop now? You're having great success. You probably shouldn't be leaving, but it's very hard for someone on the outside to look at someone like Paul and determine what's going on. And so Paul and Barnabas, and I'm sure it was after much prayer, after much consideration, said that this is the perfect time for us to flee. Not fleeing because we can't have the ministry, but fleeing because I think we are going to die. I didn't put it in last week, and my son had challenged me to do it, and so I'm going to put it in this week. This would be, to quote that chicken lover, Kenny, you got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, know when to walk away, know when to run. So this is what's happening here. Again, we're going to find out something very interesting, that it almost seems like city to city, Paul and Barnabas, problems are following them everywhere they go, and they have to make constant decisions. When should I stay and when should I go? Thankfully, again, for us, we often don't have to worry about death threats when it comes to our Christian faith. But I mean, if you think about it, would that be a hard thing to do? We've heard about this if there's ever mass shootings that take place. I've heard of people who have struggled with being bold in that situation. If someone decides to not confess Jesus Christ at that moment and tries to shield themselves from an execution, do we blame them? Or are they just simply living to fight another day? And then we hear of others that maybe stand up and are executed. This is really, really tough. Trying to understand when we should stick around with something and when we shouldn't is one of the hardest things I think we ever have to do. And we complicate it because of our own mind, because of our own will, because of our own wants and desires. It's hard, really is. So I want to keep going, because here we're going to see this interesting group of people continue on in the story. In Lystra, there sat a man crippled in his feet, who was lame from birth and had never walked. He listened to Paul as he was speaking. Paul looked directly at him and saw that he had faith to be healed and called out, "Stand up on your feet." And at that, the man jumped up and began to walk. Again, what an amazing miracle. We've heard stories like this, and hopefully we're not getting like, "Oh, well, that was a nice story. You know, Paul, you know, can't we do something a little more exciting than just healing some poor cripple?" No, this is to this guy. This is probably one of the greatest things in his entire life. He has been crippled since birth. This is not a plant in the congregation during the healing service and like, "Oh, I'm feeling that someone in the back has faith to be healed," and, "Oh, there's someone in a wheelchair and they can't really operate it that well," and you're like, "Really? Have you been in the wheelchair that long?" But, "Oh, don't worry about that." And you go there and you're like, "Can you stand up and walk?" And all of a sudden they just stand up and start walking, and it was a plant. Now, I'm not saying that that's all faith healing. Please don't get me wrong on that. But sometimes that happens. We know for a fact that this one is not some fake healing. Everybody knew Frank. Frank was the cripple. He could not walk. And now all of a sudden, Paul does this thing. Again, I wish I knew some of the mechanics, because it drives me nuts. He looks at him, somehow sees he has faith to be healed. What does that mean? Again, I think I've said it before, because Josh drew a comic about this where he said he had, like, there's a sign, like some spiritual sign over his head, like he's looking out and it's like, "No, no, 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 you can be healed." Somehow or other, he figures it out. And he looks at him and he says, "Stand up and walk." And we can go all into the other miracles that take place of, if you have not walked your entire life, how strong are your muscles? They're not. I don't even know what you got. You got nothing. And so this is something where it's not just that his legs became healed. He wasn't that he wasn't a cripple anymore, but another healing of that he goes. And how about this? How does he know how to walk? I mean, I you know, what do we do with little babies, right? We kind of stand them up, and what do? Boo! You'll fall over like the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And they just hit the ground. And what do? You have to train them. And then they can take maybe one step and then they fall. And then maybe they can take two steps and then they fall. But this guy stands up and starts walking around, starts running around. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Now, this guy ends up not becoming kind of the center of the story because other things are going to happen. But people are watching this. People are seeing this guy who had never walked is walking around, and they're taking notice saying, what should we think about this? So when the crowd saw what Paul had done, they shouted in the Lyconian language. I'm going to pause right there. So this is one of the problems. Paul's preaching, and is anyone understanding a word Paul's saying? No, it's a different language. But they see Frank. And Frank's now stood up, so they're like, something must be going on here. So they start talking in the Lyconian language. Now, I don't know if this is the point where we enter in a young man named Timothy. We know that Timothy is from this town. We know that Timothy is there with his mother and grandmother, Lois and Eunice. And we know that Timothy comes to faith at this point in some way, shape, or form. So is he there? Did he already come to faith? Is he now watching this and now he might be becoming an interpreter? We don't really know. But all we know is that these guys start going nuts. So you got to imagine you're Paul. You do this healing and all of a sudden everyone starts going crazy talking in another language. I'd start getting excited. Like, this is good. I like this. And they start shouting, the gods have come down to us in human form. Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul they called Hermes because he was the chief speaker. The priest of Zeus, whose god was just outside the temple, brought bulls and wreaths to the city gates because he and the crowd wanted to offer sacrifices to him. So there you are, you're Paul. You're like, wow, this is, look at this. Where'd they go? Where are they going? Where'd they go? Oh, I don't know. It seemed like, what do you guys think? That was pretty good. That's pretty good. Oh, they're coming back. What's going on? And then I'm wondering if, you know, maybe Timothy is running up to them and it starts whispering in his ear, oh, hey, Paul, they think that you're gods. And he's like, they think I'm what? They think you're gods, that you're Zeus and Hermes. Why would they think that we're gods? That doesn't make any sense. Why would they even consider? Well, I don't know if you remember, there was a story told back. It's one of our poets. His name was Ovid. And Ovid told the story of how Zeus and Hermes actually came down to the town and no one recognized them. And they, in fact, kind of shunned them, except there was this little old couple that kind of saw it and like said, hey, I think you're gods, and gave them hospitality. And they were the only people to show grace and favor to Zeus and Hermes. And Zeus and Hermes was so angry that they totally and utterly destroyed the town. And so we've all been waiting, like Zeus and Hermes will eventually come back. And when Zeus and Hermes come back, we've got to make sure that we recognize them. So I think they think you're this prophecy's coming back again. By the way, everything I just said to you is true. I don't know if Timothy actually said it, but that is part of the story, part of the background of why they considered them to be gods. So now these people who think that they are gods and they're starting to worship them and they're sacrificing bulls and they're offering wreaths, what would you do at that point? Okay, this is really awkward. What do we do here? Like, we are not gods. And yeah, Barnabas, I mean, do you remember what happened to King Herod? Remember he was standing out on the portico and everyone was like, oh my gosh, it's the face of a god. It's a face, you know, he's God in the flesh. And Herod, he was like, oh, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. And remember he died 3 days later of intestinal worms? Barnabas, I don't want to die of intestinal worms. That sounds painful. That sounds scary. That sounds really bad. What do you think? Well, we got to stop this. We got to tell these people that we're not gods. So this is the crowd. They're all whipped up. This is really, really cool. There's a language barrier. Somehow or other, Paul and Barnabas figure out that they're worse being worshipped. And what do they do? Verse 14. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of this, so somehow or other it gets translated back to them, they tore their clothes and rushed out into the crowd, shouting, "Men, why are you doing this?" Now, again, I would really love to see this picture because they're not speaking the Lycaonian language, right? And they're tearing their robes because they're sad. So can you get that picture in your mind? Imagine you're part of the crowd and you've come to worship this guy, these two guys, and all of a sudden they start tearing their robes. They're running around naked, shouting at the top of their lungs in some foreign language. Wouldn't that be an interesting sight to see? I'm like, what is going on here? Like, these two guys are going nutsoid, and they're ripping and screaming and weeping and wait. Oh, I don't know. Kind of a crazy story. So they're like, "Men, why are you doing this? We too are only men, human like you. We're bringing you good news, telling you to turn from these worthless things to the living God who made heaven and earth and the sea and everything in them. In the past, he let all nations go their own way, yet he has not left himself without testimony. He has shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in the sea in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your hearts with joy." And of course, I'm wondering, is it Timothy or someone else is doing the translation? That's crazy. They're trying to say, look, don't worship me. You got to worship God. Now, taking a look at this little mini sermon that they've preached, what important name has been left out of this entire discussion? Do you notice that not once do they mention Jesus Christ to this crowd? Not once do they mention an Old Testament prophecy? Why is that? Well, it's because they don't know him. Like, these are people that have no clue who a Messiah is, who Jesus is, what the Torah is. They are absolutely clueless. But what do they know? They know about Zeus, and they know about Hermes. And of course, I did not check this with my local expert, but Joshua, can you verify this for me? Zeus was the god of rain, and Hermes was the god of food. That's what I get. Because what people have looked at is, why does he focus, why does he zero in on this God of creation who sends you water and rain so you can find food? He's trying to say, look, you're looking to Zeus and Hermes for answers, but you're not finding them in the right spot. You're looking in all the wrong places. You got to look to the one and only God, and we're not it. And they're just trying to explain to them that you don't need to worship me. I'm not the one even to be worshiped. Instead, worship God. He's the one that's doing all this. And you got to imagine, it's got to be weird. Here they are. They've all brought, you know, you've all brought your bowls and your wreaths and everything seemed, and I'm trying to explain this to you, and now you're kind of looking at me like, huh, well, that's an interesting thought. So you're not Zeus and Hermes, but are you saying, like, there's someone stronger than Zeus and Hermes, or is there someone other than Zeus and Hermes, or is there even a Zeus and Hermes and there's just God? This is all really strange. And they're having this conversation. It's really, really fascinating. And so I love this because verse 18, even with these words, they had difficulty keeping the crowd from sacrificing to them. So they're trying their best. Please don't worship us. And yet, they still do. And it's really awkward. I don't know how I should feel about this. I don't know what I should do about this, but I guess I'll keep on trying. And then enter in the other people. Then some Jews came from Antioch and Iconium. Where was Antioch and Iconium? That's what we just covered. If you look back, you can see that this is where Paul and Barnabas are traveling. The Jewish people are following them. I actually wrote this in my Bible. Don't they have other better things to do with their life? Like, why are they doing this? And I really question these guys. And I get it. For people who are waiting for the Messiah, they had become myopic. Like, this is what the Messiah looks like. This is what the Messiah will do. This is how the Messiah will act. This is how the Messiah will rule and reign. This is how the Messiah is going to save the Jewish nation to get out from under Roman rule. Their myopicness, myopicness? I don't know. Because they were so myopic, they could not see the Messiah right in front of their face. Their belief system had strangled everything else, even when there was clear, concrete evidence to the contrary. They did not care. And what makes this worse is that they didn't just simply reject the message. They didn't just simply say, you know what, I don't believe that Jesus is the Messiah. I mean, could you imagine if you went out and spoke to someone about Jesus Christ, and let's say they rejected the message. You know, at the end of it, they'd probably just say, don't believe you. I don't think that's right. I don't think that's true, but, you know, thank you very much. Do you think they're going to come after you to kill you? Like, this is a group of people that isn't even polite about it. They're like, we are going to hunt you down and gut you like a fish. We are going to make sure that you somehow pay for this. We are not only myopic in our viewpoint, we can't see anything around us that it gives us tunnel vision to even hate you and despise you and want you dead. It's times like this you have to ask yourself the question. It's times like this that you have to do the introspection and say, am I one of those people? Am I someone who is myopic in certain things that are not biblical? Please don't get me wrong on that. The Bible, that's a little bit different, right? You know, gosh, should I kill this person? The answer is no, that's murder. Should I steal from this person? Okay, be myopic on that, and yeah, don't steal, right? This would be other things that are not biblical. Are there times that maybe you get so myopic that it has to go this way? I think this is one of the reasons why those TV shows about like house hunters is a dangerous thing, because what ends up happening is these people say, well, my house that I get has to have granite countertops, open floor plan, and they get it in their brain. This is how it's got to be, and so I can't see anything else outside of that, so I'm just going to stay myopic. Maybe it's when you go to buy a car and you say to yourself, it has to have air conditioning. Well, yeah, I know, it really should have air conditioning, but does it really have to? Because all of a sudden, it has to have this, it has to have this, it has to have this, and it's got to be under X amount of dollars. We become so myopic. We can't see this good car right in front of us that may not be perfect, and it may not have everything, but our myopicness has frozen us and has caused us to not see anything else around us. Have you become myopic in hatred? Certain things you hate. I do. I hate. I hate, 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 hate with a passion. Peas. Disgusting. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Jim. And it was interesting because I've grown up like that. I hate peas, and I also hate nuts. I hate peas, I hate nuts. And I remember the first time I had encountered Panda Express. And I looked down, and you got chow mein and fried rice. And I'm like, well, I'll have some of the fried rice. I think that sounds good. And then they gave it to me, and I looked, and I was like, wait. It's peas. Because I hate peas. Side note, if you ever want to know why I don't like peas, I've told this story in the past, but I think it bears repeating. And I don't know why my father did this to me. He traumatized me as a kid. They had a little ditty back in the olden days, and it went like this. I eat my peas with honey. I've done it all my life. It makes the peas taste funny, but it keeps them on the knife. Right? Right? You're like, so the very first time who said that? Was that you, Catherine? Yeah, sorry. It's because of mass, I'm like, I don't know who said that. He took the knife and he put it in the honey and he dabbed it on the peas and like, here you go, son. And so I'm like, well, okay, well, Dad says it's good, so I guess I'm going to go ahead and eat it. I ate it. I was like, this is disgusting. I hate peas. And it is true that my mom also served me peas from a can. Yeah. Right, yeah, so this is why I hate peas. And then I remember, I was like, well, am I so myopic that I can't see this? It's justifiable, thank you. And I also remember when I first ate a peanut, because remember, up until then, I hated nuts. I don't like nuts. And then I ate it, I was like, oh, wasn't that bad? I guess that's not too shabby. Do we sometimes do that with God? God says, hey, maybe you should try this. What if you talk to your neighbor about me? And you're like, nope, don't do that. That's not me. I don't have that gift. Nope, never mind. Nope, no, no, nope, 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 nope. Hey, you know what you should do? Why don't you trust me in your finances? Nope, nope, nope. God helps those who help themselves. I'm sure that's from somewhere in the Bible. I'm convinced of it. It's not. And so I've got to do everything. I've got to do it all. I've got to do it all. I've got to do it all. Or people who have a hard time coming into a church because my life has to be all together before I can come into the presence of God. And so I can't do it. I won't come. I won't come. I won't come. I won't come. I think that sometimes when we become my, and again, especially for these Jewish people who had the evidence. What was the evidence? A man who was crippled since birth is now walking. Now that is something to behold. And even in the face of that evidence, they're looking squarely at it and they're like, nope. Still don't believe. Now, again, I don't think any of us are going to be like these guys, so myopic that it turns out that we kill someone. But I think we all do this to God to some degree. Maybe we do this to our spouses to some degree. Do this to our kids to some degree. And we should always be very careful that if we get to a point where what we're doing is essentially damaging and hurting the people around us, maybe we need to rethink what we're doing. So these are these guys, and what do? The Jews from Antioch and Iconium, they won the crowd over. I'm not too sure how. I don't know. Did they have a translator? But I don't know how they kept on talking to him. They're like, hey, these guys are evil. I wouldn't be surprised if it was something along the line of they're using demonic activity in order to make this guy walk. I don't know if maybe they said, oh, yeah, they don't think that they claim they're not Zeus and Hermes, and that's because they think Zeus and Hermes is an old fairy tale, and they actually hate your guts. That's why they're ripping off their clothes and screaming at the top of their lungs. They actually think you guys are just a bunch of idiots. Somehow or other, they're weaving this tale, this web, and this crowd starts buying into it. And this crowd that had brought bulls and wreaths to worship Paul and Barnabas, it goes from praise to death threats. They come, and they won the crowd over. And in this verse that is has got to be probably one of the hardest verses to think about, so quick. We skim over it. They stoned Paul and dragged him outside of the city, thinking he was dead. Now imagine, you are Paul, and they've grabbed you. And at first you thought, well, I don't know, what are they grabbing? Are they going to put me up on a throne? No, no, guys, no, I'm really not. What do they do? Why are they picking up rocks? What is going, hey, can someone please translate here? Yeah, they don't like you anymore. They're going to kill you. Hold on a second. Wait. This is not a good idea. And all of a sudden, from the back, a big giant rock hits Paul in the head, and he falls over. And now what would you do if you're Paul at that moment? Did he start thinking about Stephen? That was the guy who he watched being stoned to death. Remember, he was the one holding the rose. Remember the story? Yeah. And he's sitting there, and he's probably going, so this is what it's like. This is what it's like to be stoned. And then another rock comes in, breaks his kneecap, and he screams out in pain. Okay, I'm not getting out of this. I'm not getting out of this alive. And there's probably others that are trying to stop and, you know, grab rocks out of their hand. No, don't do it. Don't do it. No, he's a good guy. No. And rocks start piling in and piling on. And all of a sudden, if you're Barnabas, what do? You look, and there the guy is on the ground with blood coming out of his body, and he is not moving an inch. That's it. End of Paul's life. He's dead. Finally, the bloodthirsty crowd who'd been won over by the Jews said, well, I guess we wait around for the real Zeus and Hermes, because if they were Zeus and Hermes, they would have stopped us. Let's go. And they drag Paul's dead body outside the city, because it's kind of gross just leaving a dead body sitting inside the city gates. They just dump him like trash. I don't know what happened. Paul's last thoughts. God, I deserve this. God, I have hurt other people so much. I deserve to die. And God, I'm coming home. I trust in you. Forgive me from what I've done. Yet I know that sometimes I have to pay this price. And then he's gone. All right, you already know the end of the story. We know that Paul's not actually dead. This is the time in the movie. It's a very specific writing plot. I've read all about this. Yeah, Joshua, I know. I had to read this book for my doctoral program to help me with writing stuff. And every movie follows a very specific pattern about good guys and bad guys. And always, right near the end of the story, we have what's called the near-death experience. Right? What happened with Hercules? Meg died, and there was nothing Hercules could do about it. There's so many times that we've been watching movies, and it gets to a point, and they're dead. You got tangled. What happens at the end? Flynn Rider is dead, we think. Beauty and the Beast. The Beast is dead. Okay, so Paul's not dead. If you were getting really sad, I'm really sorry. Paul's not dead. Just to, you know, there's more to the story. Stay tuned. But that's what they think. But after the disciples had gathered around him, he got up and went back into the city. Luke, you stink as a writer. Oh my God. Like, what happened? And all it says is that there the body is, and like, what would you do? Like, you're Barnabas, and you got a couple other disciples with you, and there's Paul, and he's on the ground. Like, I don't know, what should we do? Do we maybe hold a service? Do we say some nice things about this guy? I don't know. Maybe we should, I don't know, do you want to form a prayer circle? That's it, because that's actually what it says, is that they went over to the body and they just encircled it. So they all were standing there. We should hold hands. Yeah, let's hold hands. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Barnabas, say something nice. Dear Lord, thank you for Paul. Thank you for his life. Thank you for Paul, quiet. Paul, I'm praying. Paul, Paul, stop moaning and Paul? Because all of a sudden, Paul starts moving around. And right, and that's the Beauty and the Beast and the teardrop frozen. I love you. And all of a sudden, the beast starts moving. And right, you know, and then he's alive. I think that's amazing. Same thing with Hercules and Meg, right? He goes all the way down into Hades. And he reaches down and gets her and pulls her up and grabs her out. And we're like, yeah. This is what they're doing. All of a sudden, Paul starts moving. We should help him up. Quick, someone get some bandages and something. Call 911 or anything. It would be IXII, I know. And Paul's moving, and they're like, let's get him up. So they're like, okay. Now, could you imagine them walking back through the city? You know, here's this dude, and he's totally messed up. And they're kind of walking him, and they're like, is anyone seeing us? Wait, someone's coming here, Paul, back here. Hi, how are you? Hi, nothing to see here, no, there's not a dead person that's behind me, no, you're good. Okay, good to see you later, how would I say, yeah, all right, and then they go. Where are the mechanics? How did this work? Did anyone actually pray for Paul to come back to life? Why wasn't that recorded? It just, he's dead, but he's now alive. Isn't that crazy? As we sang before, what does God love to do? He turns graves into gardens because he's the only one who can. He's the only one. Fantastic. Okay, so I know I got one verse left, and you're like, please, just finish up. I'm almost there. What would you do if you were Paul? I don't know, Paul. What would you do, Paul? Would you be like, I think we need to try this again? I think this is tough. As I said, it is really hard. I wish I kind of understood kind of Paul's mentality. But yeah, it's never up to me to judge for someone what someone else does. Paul knew he had to go. Paul knew we got to step away from here. And so he says, let's do it. And again, I think it truly is this remarkable thing, because what ends up happening is this incredible return later on. It's amazing. I'm only in the middle of the chapter. I'm sorry, here I go. I'll go faster. Thank you. I'm so bad. So the next day, he and Barnabas left for Derbe. So they preached the good news in that city where they won a large number of disciples. Then they returned to Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch. Are these people nuts? Are you kidding me? You almost got killed there. I think we should stop by and say hi. I think that would be kind of fun. And they're like walking in like, hey, isn't that the dead guy? Didn't we kill him earlier? Nah, he was actually only mostly dead. Yeah, this poor guy, and I'm sure he's walking with a limp. And again, I'm staying away, but if you ever want to do a dive into some other things, Paul talks about this incident where he dies, and he's brought up to the third level of heaven. And he gets to see things that no one else has seen. And then he doesn't write about it. I swear, these people, come on, you went to hell. Tell us what happened. Come back and say something. But this is, again, fascinating that Paul dies, and he comes back, and he says, I love these people so much. I want them to know about Jesus Christ, and I will do anything that I can. Now, I can imagine if Paul ever had the chance to become myopic, wouldn't that be it? Right? Be walking into town. Oh, there's Lystra. Oh, no, we're going to go over this way. I remember years ago when we had gone to Heather's family's house for Christmas, and we had brought our dog, Rouse, with us. And my in-laws, Heather's mom and dad, grandmas and grandpas lived across the street from each other. Makes it very convenient when Christmas comes, right? Like, who are we going to go see? Well, I'll be in one house, and then I'll just, you know, walk across the street to the other house. So we're in the one house. This is Robert's parents, Chet and Claire, and we're having, and then we're like, well, now we should go over and see John and Sally. Now, it's very interesting. John and Sally have five very extremely large German shepherds. So here we are with our little dog, Rouse, and we're, you know, kind of tootling across the street. We're like, ooh, going to the other house, and we get up, and Rouse is only like, I don't know, this big, and a German shepherd is, you know, kind of like this big. And so they come out, and they're like, ooh, Christmas meal. This is all snacky poo. This is great. And they dove on the dog. And, of course, I'm jumping on the dog, and I'm kind of surrounding it, and the dogs are biting at me, and the dog's freaking out, and John and Sally come out, and they're like, get back at that, you know, and then the dog, okay. And so, and then I go back across to the other side, and I'm like, okay, sorry, Rouse, and she's okay, this is good, all right, okay. So I'm like, let's try this again. And so I put us on the leash. We started walking across the street. And in the middle of the street, guess what the dog did? It took off. And it was like, I could not drag her. She was like, nope, over there is mean and nasty and horrible doggies that are going to kill me. That's what if Paul had ever the chance to be myopic, that would be it. But he doesn't. He loves these people too much. He says, I may not understand it. I don't know why this is happening. But I have been sent on a mission from God to love and care for these people, and so that's what I'm going to do. And so they essentially are, if you track it on a map, the way they're traveling, they're essentially, they've gotten as far as they can, and now they're returning back to Jerusalem, because that's chapter 15, a huge religious gathering is taking place. So they're returning back through Lystra, Iconium, and they're strengthening the disciples. They're encouraging them to remain true in the faith, right? Wouldn't that be a great story? You guys got to just remain true. But what if they kill you? You know, happened to me. I died. I made it through. I was with God and sent back here to you guys. Kind of liked it there better, but you know, this is my mission. This is what I'm supposed to do. We must go through hardships to enter the kingdom of God. Hard, that's what you're calling this, hardships. Wow. It's a reminder for us, right? When we enter through hardships, like Paul died. Yeah. Paul and Barnabas appointed elders for them in each church. They're like, okay, you guys, we're going to have to set some stuff up. We need some elders. We need people who have been a long time in the faith. Okay, who, none of you. That's right, because you all just became Christians. Okay, never mind. We're going to just appoint some people, and we're going to make this do it. And they did it with prayer and fasting. They committed to the Lord in whom they had put their trust. And after going through Pisidia, they came into Pamphylia, and when they had preached the word in Perga, they went down to Attaliah, and from Attaliah they sailed back to Antioch, where they'd been committed to the grace of God for the work they had now completed. On arriving there, they gathered the church together and reported all that God had done through them and how he had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles. And they stayed there a long time with the disciples. When we live on the praise of people, you've heard me say this, when we live on the praise of people, it's a fickle diet, because these people who saw Paul and Barnabas as gods and they were sacrificing to him turned around and killed him. And yet Paul still had a heart for them. Now that, if that is not the definition of grace, I don't know what is. Because there was another one who was one day coming into Jerusalem, and he was hailed as a king. They grabbed a bunch of palm branches, they put it down so that his donkey didn't have to step on a horrible road. It's fit for a king, and they're yelling out, this is it, the Hosanna to the Son of David, and they're calling for him to rise up, and you can do this. And then what do? Just a couple days later, kill him. Crucify him. We want him dead. Man, if there was ever time for Jesus to be myopic, wait, Wasn't I just hailed as a hero not that long ago? Because Jesus knew something. It wasn't about the praise of the people or the cries of death from the people. You know what mattered most? The love in Jesus' heart. And he knew that they were going to call for his death, and yet he still died for them anyway. He knew all the sins you were going to commit, and he still died for you anyway. If Jesus is myopic on anything, it is one thing. He loves you dearly. And it'd be great if we could get out of some of the pain and hardship in this world. But Paul says it's going to happen. Maybe not as dramatic as dying, but stuff that still affects us anyway. And may we always know that through that, God will never abandon us, God will never forsake us, God will never leave us, because God loves us dearly. Let's pray. Lord, it is so hard when we become myopic in life, myopic in our faith. We insist that something has to happen this way, but yet we don't ever often leave room for you. We do that with people who have hurt us, and yet you love them and love us through it. And we pray, Lord, that as we do stuff in life, that it would never be about receiving praise from you. Instead, that it would be about how you love us. And out of everything, that is the most important thing. So may we become myopic in knowing of your love for us. That even if people hail us as heroes, as gods, as the most amazing thing in this world, we would still only be thinking of one thing, and that's how much you love us. And when people call for our, maybe not our death, but they call for other things, and there's this level of vitriol that comes in. Lord, may we just simply still rest in the proclamation that you love us, and nothing can take that away. So thank you for all that you have done for us because of Jesus Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen.